Hi, this is Michael Osterlink with Take Back Medicine Audio Blog and AAPS Online. And I'm here with Alan Phillips, vaccine rights attorney and founder of the Pandemic Response Project. Good afternoon, Alan.
Good afternoon, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
It's great to have you. First, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a vaccine rights attorney and what that actually means in practice?
Sure. I'm a so-called second career attorney. I went back to school and picked law school after being out from undergraduate school for 17 years, primarily because of my concern and interest in the subject of vaccinations. I stumbled onto the vaccine controversy when my oldest child was born a little over 16 years ago at this point, or actually closer to 17 years at this point. And found a book by Neil Miller, Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? And it was a real eye-opening book, and I just have continued ever since that time researching the subject and finding that there are a lot of serious concerns about immunizations and immunization laws and policy. And at one point was moved to go back to school and go to law school because I thought that would put me in a position to be more effective in addressing this issue and related issues, and have since learned that there are very few attorneys anywhere in the country whose practice includes on any regular basis working with clients, helping them with vaccine exemptions and waivers. So at present, my work in the vaccine arena falls sort of generally into two categories. One is my practice, the larger part of which concerns or involves working with people with vaccine exemptions and waivers in about a dozen different contexts in which the question comes up in the United States, how do I avoid immunizations legally? And then seeing in particular the way that the so-called swine flu pandemic of the last several months played out and how things have played out since, and seeing a lot of problems with that, have had a focus on emergency health laws, and that brings me into the second larger category of my work with vaccines, which has to do with activism and reform of current laws to address the limitations in current laws on our right to choose to accept or refuse vaccines as a matter of choice or the lack of ability thereof, depending on the specific situation, and involving getting myself involved more and more with legislative initiatives, not only here in my own state of North Carolina, but helping people in other states around the country to expand the right to choose.
Wow. So I think it'd be helpful for our listening audience, perhaps, if you spend a little bit of time on each of these two related but different issues. When it comes to individuals, and you said that they come to you and you're their attorney, and they want to seek legal means of protecting themselves against particular vaccines, can you give examples of exemptions in the various states that people can use to free themselves from the coerced nature of some of these vaccines?
In a sense, there are sort of two different aspects to the question or the answer to the question, and maybe an implication, if unwitting or unintended on your part in the question, and that is there are many, many different contexts in which the question comes up, how do I avoid vaccines legally? So just some quick examples, like the most obvious one that most people think of, and that is probably the one the largest number of people deal with, has to do with their children enrolling in schools. But even in the school category, there are several subdivisions. There are public schools, private schools, home schools, military schools, colleges versus grade schools, all of these different categories or subdivisions of the school issue with vaccines can have different laws that apply, different rights accordingly, may have to be approached in uniquely different ways from one another and from the other different contexts. And just real briefly, there are questions of, and vaccine requirements and exemptions, issues with immigration, which includes adopting children from foreign countries, military, and there are subcategories there. There are different laws for civilian contractors and military service members, their families, their children in military schools. The question has come up for me a lot in the employer-employee context with the playing out of the swine flu pandemic as more and more hospitals started implementing policies requiring seasonal and swine flu of their employees. And so, again, just it can come up in a lot of different issues. Another context that I've seen more and more in the last maybe 3 years or so of my practice is what I refer to as vaccine custody disputes. The typical situation, although there are variations, is where parents agree not to vaccinate a child, and then they separate or divorce, and one parent decides to change sides and go pro-vaccine because they think they can use that to get an advantage in a custody dispute. And it turns out custody cases are heavily or can be heavily fact-dependent, but it turns out that in a lot of these cases there are some very strong legal arguments favoring the pro-exemption parent, but predictably, most attorneys and judges, their first very reasonable kind of response is going to be, of course, it's in the best interest of the child to vaccinate them. Why would you even raise the question? But again, if you know, depending on the specific facts and history in the case, and if you know the arguments to make, there are some arguments to be made. And I've seen success in these cases for the pro-exemption parent, working with attorneys, family law attorneys, and a handful or more of different states around the country in the last 3 years or so. So it's, again, there's just a lot of different situations and circumstances and contexts in which the question comes up. Having said that, I think what you really were aiming at with your question is there are three general categories of exemptions that every state or federal context, and federal would be immigration, military, or U.S. territories, Washington, D.C. Every state or federal context has one or more of three different exemption types. There are medical exemptions everywhere. There are religious exemptions in most states and in all federal contexts, as far as I know. And then the least widely available is the philosophical or personal exemption, although they're available in something like 20 states, but because of the particular 20 states, it's my understanding that they're available for a majority of citizens in the United States, but still in a minority of individual states by count of states.
Now, I know you're a wealth of resources of information on this. Is there a website that people can visit, one of your sites, where they can find out the various state laws and the exemptions that you just spoke about?
Well, I do have I have two different websites on the vaccine issue, and the one that is concerned with my practice and information about rights to refuse vaccines is vaccinerights.com, and lots of free information on that site, a Q&A. Just a quick comment, and it's a delicate one, so I'm going to try to be as sensitive as I can about this. There are a lot of websites, anti-vaccine or pro-vaccine choice websites that have information about exemptions and waivers. And what I have seen for the most part, and this even includes some highly reputable sites from alternative medical doctors or vaccine book authors, but for the most part, from what I've seen, when they get into talking about vaccine exemptions and waivers, rights and procedures, they almost invariably have a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information. And I believe this is absolutely inadvertent on their part. They're trying to help people avoid immunizations, and I consider all these people my peers and allies in raising vaccine awareness. Unfortunately, the law is just more complicated than most of these folks realize, and they suffer from what I sometimes refer to as the what you don't know that you don't know syndrome. That is, given the information and understanding they have, what they say is very reasonable. Unfortunately, oftentimes it includes some erroneous information, and there are people who have lost exemption rights by relying on information from the Internet. Mm. So with the utmost respect for all concerned, I do strongly recommend that people be very cautious in looking at and relying on information about exemptions and waivers on the Internet just generally. Unfortunately, there's no way for me to offer those words of caution without it seeming or being, quite frankly, self-serving. For what it's worth, I'm doing the work that I'm doing with vaccines out of a passion for the issue. If I wanted to see how much money I can make with a law license. I wouldn't touch this area of law. It's not a lucrative practice area by any means. But I'm compelled by the issue, and I'm here doing the work. Now, the information I have on my site comes out of my research on vaccination exemption and waiver law and my now several years of experience working in a wide variety of different contexts. So we always, reasonable folks will always put some kind of a disclaimer on website saying the information is, you know, accurate and up to date to the best of our ability, but, you know, may not be fully up to date. It's for educational purposes only and the like. And I have such a disclaimer on my site as well. But I think it is really one of the more reliable sites for accurate and more in-depth information than you'll see on other sites as well. Having said that, I also offer an ebook on my site where I've gone into greater depth introducing exemption and waiver law. There is a focus on religious exemptions and religious objections to vaccines because that seems to be not only the most complicated of the three exemption types legally, but the one that more people are involved with, at least if they're involved in it in a way that they really need to have information about how to exercise it. Philosophical exemptions, where they're available, if you know it's available, that's usually a fairly straightforward thing to exercise. You don't need an attorney for that. And, of course, no one's ever required to hire an attorney or buy an e-book or anything else to exercise a legal right. As a practical matter, though, there are a lot of pitfalls in potentially in the exercise of religious exemptions in particular, if you are exercising one in a state or federal arena in which you are required to write what I refer to as a statement of beliefs. Now, a lot of states have forms. I think California, for example, among others, where you just turn the form over and check a box. You don't need to read an e-book or hire an attorney for that. But if you're dealing with a situation where you do have to write a statement of beliefs, and if you're in a state or other context in which the authorities involved have the legal right, according to the wording of the particular statute or regulation, to scrutinize your exemption claim, that's a place where you should consider getting some more information, wherever you can find it, from someone knowledgeable and experienced in this arena, because there are, again, particularly in those situations, potential pitfalls.
This is Michael Ostlenk with TakeBackMedicine.org audio blog and AAPSOnline.org, and I'm talking to Alan Phillips, a vaccine rights attorney and founder of the Pandemic Response Project. Let me ask you a question, because you talked about medical, philosophical, and religious exemptions. Medical seems pretty clear to me. You know, a doctor can claim that if you take a certain vaccine that it could have dire consequences and therefore you shouldn't take it. Or philosophical, you explained, you just have a philosophical disagreement with taking a particular vaccine. But religious, in the states they require you to do more than just check off a check mark. How can you prove that you shouldn't be taking a vaccine? Do you have to go back to a certain religious text, like if you're a Christian, the Bible? I mean, how does that actually work in practice to show that you should have a religious exemption?
Well, if I may, I'm going to digress just briefly to the medical, because it is the smaller conversation by far of the two. But I just want to point out that depending on the wording of the state law, some states have the ability to scrutinize medical exemptions as well.
Oh, really?
And so there are situations where you have a doctor who recommends the exemption, but it may be denied anyway. And so, unfortunately, even the medical exemptions can be complicated and frustrating to deal with. I will say, as a general rule, that where you want to avoid vaccines generally and indefinitely, that even if you qualify or even if you may qualify for medical, if you also qualify for the religious, I would recommend people look at the religious. And here's why. The religious right, starting point is that no states are required to offer a religious exemption, which makes it sort of curious that 48 of them do. It really is, that in and of itself is testimony to the value and weight that we as a society place on religion and religious beliefs and our right to the free exercise of religion. But with religious exemptions, you have federal First Amendment rights that kind of kick in with it. I mean, common sense, at least to me, would say that if a state doesn't have to offer a religious exemption, they ought to be able to qualify it any way they want to if they do offer it. But it turns out that legally they can't do that. Once the state offers a religious exemption, they are bound and required to offer that consistent with the rights and obligations of the First Amendment free exercise of religion. So then the question, of course, legitimately and reasonably arises, well, what does that really mean? I mean, the Constitution and the First Amendment don't say anything about vaccines, so how do we know what the free exercise of religion is or means with regard to immunization exemptions? Well, the way that we find out the boundaries of our rights as it might pertain to the application of constitutional provisions or statutes or regulations to specific situations, whenever there's any confusion about that and whenever there's a formal legal dispute about that, is in the form of legal precedent. So when there's a formal dispute, and in the state courts, that usually means, in order to get to a place where legal precedent is generated, that usually means there would have to be an appeal from the trial court level. In the federal system, even the trial court levels can write legal precedent. The courts can write published opinions that then serve as legal precedent. So there is a body of legal precedent in with regard to vaccine religious exemptions. It's a fairly niche area of the law, but there is some precedent out there. Most of the precedent that defines the boundaries of our rights in this arena comes from federal district courts in New York. There's a smattering of cases in state courts around the country and from federal courts from two or three other states. But the majority of it, at least as it pertains to what are the boundaries of our rights, come from federal district courts in New York. Now, there's a real important technical point of distinction with regard to that, and that is this, that since the New York federal courts, their jurisdiction is wholly within the state of New York, the court decisions coming out of those courts on this topic are only binding on the state of New York. They serve as what is called persuasive precedent for the rest of the country. That's the legal technicality. The practical matter is that courts around the country have been following the New York precedent consistently. And so while that's a potentially important technical distinction, that is, if the same conflict came up in another state or federal court outside of New York, that court could rule differently because the New York precedent is not binding, it's only persuasive. But again, this is a matter of practical reality. Courts in other parts of the country have been following the precedent. So what does some of that precedent tell us? It answers some of the questions that help define the boundaries of our rights when we exercise religious exemption. For example, a few, if any, state religious exemption statutes make a reference to whether or not you can exercise the right if you or if you're exercising on behalf of a child, if the child has had previous vaccines. Does that keep you from exercising religious exemption? Does it matter if you belong to an organized church or not? Do you have to be a member of a church that has tenets opposed to immunization or not? Now, some state laws still have that requirement. Maybe I can come back to that in a minute. But some of the legal precedent also addresses, does it matter if you belong to a church at all? Well, it turns out that from this legal precedent, there really are only two requirements for First Amendment protection, and that is that the religious belief or beliefs have to be religious, and they have to be sincerely held. So there are some cases that help explain what that really means in more specific ways. So, for example, there were parents who had whose religious beliefs stemmed from their former association with Native American Indians, Hopi and other Native American Indians. The courts upheld that as valid religious beliefs for legal purposes, and those folks got the vaccine exemption. So we can see that the exemption, according to that particular precedent, is rather broad in how what qualifies as religious beliefs. There was another federal court case where a chiropractor claimed that his beliefs, which stemmed from his chiropractic philosophy, were religious beliefs. And while the court acknowledged that they were sincerely held and a firm conviction and so forth, at the end of the day they said, no, that didn't really get over the line between philosophical and religious, and so that person lost the case and lost the exemption. So we have, again, sort of a handful of points of reference, and this is just part of the way our larger legal system works. That is, we have certain rights, and then how they are applied in specific situations is often something that's answered in legal precedent. And to the degree that there is legal precedent, boundaries are defined. And to the degree that there isn't legal precedent or that specific issues haven't been litigated and resulting in legal precedent, certain legal issues can be unresolved or undefined.
Wow. Well, that's very helpful, Alan. I appreciate that. There's two aspects to this conversation. One was just the exemptions and the rights of individuals outside of an emergency situation just defined by the state or the federal government. Another part of your work is, as you're the founder of the Pandemic Response Project, and that's more about state emergency powers and the powers that states have legally, because they pass laws that give them the authority to require you to or mandate you to get certain vaccines or to be quarantined or other certain measures. Can you speak about your organization, your project, what you're up to, and some of these powers that you see the various states have? And can you also, specifically related to the H1N1 vaccine issues that we recently faced?
Sure. As you might imagine from my work over several years with vaccine exemptions, last summer and last fall I started getting a number of calls of people asking me about the swine flu vaccine and what do I have to do to legally avoid this if it's mandated. And there were a number of things that were unique, some intriguing and some disturbing about the way the pandemic played out and the way that it continues to play out. I keep thinking we're going to hit sort of a lull in the excitement, but I have information coming across my desk from around the world on a regular basis, and there's just this constant flow of information and new updates relating to the swine flu pandemic and the vaccines. It's just sort of fascinating and mind-boggling at the same time. But what I discovered as I was getting calls and looking into this, among many different things, first of all, a lot of people who had no concerns about the larger vaccine issue were asking questions about the swine flu. So this was the first time that I had seen a vaccine issue either kind of hit mainstream or get as close to it as I've seen any other vaccine get. I saw polls from around the world where majorities of medical professionals were refusing the swine flu vaccine. I thought that was, to me personally, was unexpected and very interesting. But what I discovered, you know, in regard to the specific question that people kept asking over and over again, how to avoid the swine flu if it's mandated, what I discovered is that emergency laws around the country, emergency health laws, allow states, in the vast majority of instances from what I've seen at this point, that in the context of a declared emergency, states can mandate vaccines and throw exemptions out the window. I've even seen a couple of laws that throw medical exemptions out the window, which is just plain out perplexing to me, because the 1905 Jacobson Supreme Court case, which is arguably the seminal vaccine case and by many considered to be sort of the standard by which current vaccine policy has been set up, although there are some inconsistencies there. But nonetheless, it's sort of the legal source that gets pointed to over and over again with a wide variety of vaccine issues and questions. Seems to say to me, as I read it, that anyone who has a, and it was a case that looked at a local emergency at that point in time, smallpox, but nonetheless seemed to say to me that if you've got, if you've got a medical doctor saying that you've got a significant chance of serious adverse reaction, you know, you have a constitutional right to say no to the vaccine. So it's disturbing to me when I see laws that will throw even medical exemptions out the window. But it turns out that many states' laws allow, in the context of a declared emergency, vaccines and other medical protocol treatments and what have you to be imposed on us without any right at all for us to say, either extremely limited or even no right at all to say no. And this also goes to quarantine, that many of these same laws include sections or subsections that allow state authorities in their discretion to quarantine anybody who's not vaccinated and in a location of their choosing, which necessarily would include government facilities or other locations. Michael, I've spent many years poo-pooing the so-called conspiracy theories, but I keep seeing more and more information that points me back in the direction of at least some of them. And this is one that I have trouble keeping my imagination down, because it just seems too convenient to me that a bunch of unvaccinated people get quarantined in a government facility and then something breaks out, quote-unquote accidentally, and they all get sick or die or what have you, and there becomes even more justification for everybody else to be scared into getting their vaccines. I just really find the idea that I can be told where to do a quarantine other than my home, if I choose to do it in my home, very disturbing. And having done many, many years of research on vaccines and been long ago convinced that not only are vaccines not safe and not reliably effective, but that there are other more effective, less expensive, and much safer alternatives. And from a pure assessment of what is the best way to treat the concerns surrounding infectious disease, both prevention of disease and treatment of disease, there are better ways to do it than those ways that are advocated, in my opinion and in my research, and then those ways that are being not only advocated by the allopathic community generally, but imposed on us with regard to immunizations by our own government. What I see is a lack of any clear line between the pharmaceutical industry and our government, and there is kind of a swinging door there employment-wise as well. And so I just feel like we are not in a place at this point in the evolution of our society's politics to have the kind of clear lines for our government to be able to make objective calls about that. And therefore, we should have the right, at minimum, the right to choose. If there's going to be a mandate, it should always come with, unless you have a good reason to believe otherwise or to do otherwise, even if it requires you to do that in consultation with the healthcare professional or professionals of your choice. There are a lot of different views and opinions of vaccines, and I'm just real uncomfortable with our government deciding which one that I should have to abide by.
Alan, where can people learn more about your project?
The Pandemic Response Project has a separate website from the vaccinerights.com site. It is linked from the homepage of vaccinerights.com. You can also get there directly at pandemicresponseproject.com. So I got a little bit sidetracked there, Mike, if you'll allow me just another couple of minutes to sort of reel myself back in. The Pandemic Response Project, it has a focus on the reform of emergency health laws, primarily at the state level. There certainly are some as well at the federal level, but our focus is on the state level because the federal government doesn't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents directly. At least that's my understanding of the law, and I've had confirmation from that from the Congressional Research Service, among other folks. And so most of us are concerned with this issue as state residents, most of us in the U.S. are, and that's our primary focus. Several weeks ago, I started doing what I refer to as mapping out the vaccine choice agenda, and to my surprise, I was quite surprised, I identified about a dozen or more state-level issues. I think most of those are of concern or relevance to most states. The one that most people think of first is philosophical exemptions, and I would agree right along with anyone else who feels this way with absolutely no hesitation that I think every state should have a philosophical exemption. Everyone should have the right to say no thank you and not have to justify it on the basis of a religious belief or a medical need. There are reasons why those folks in states that offer both the religious and philosophical might want to look at the religious anyway, and it has to do with the fact that the religious comes with that First Amendment constitutional support is a stronger right than a philosophical exemption that's just a state right. But nonetheless, I think we should all have that philosophical right. But given that an emergency can be declared and the exemption is thrown out the window, fighting to get a philosophical exemption and succeeding in that, while a terrific win and a project that I'll support anyone in doing any way I can, it sort of, to me, takes a secondary level of importance and priority to the emergency reform of emergency health laws, because if they can throw exemptions out the window, what's the point in getting one? So the Pandemic Response Project is focused on reforming emergency health laws. Now, we are, at this point, sort of a informal organization. We're not incorporated in any way, profit or nonprofit. But we do have an organizational structure. We have lots of information about the swine flu pandemic. And this was, as the name implies, a response to the gross mishandling of the swine flu pandemic. And I could go on at length with examples of that if you'd like. But the sort of net result of which is, for example, we now know that emergencies, pandemics, and emergencies both can be declared even when they don't really exist, which is really the case with the swine flu pandemic. And we know that vaccines can be mandated in these non-existent emergencies and pandemics. That happened in New York temporarily last fall. Healthcare workers in New York were legally required to get the swine flu vaccines. And so we know these things can happen, and that they can happen whether they're justified by what's really going on in the world or not. And that's a very disturbing fact, all the more reason why we should have the right to choose and that we need to reform these laws. So the PandemicResponseProject.com website has lots of information talking about how the pandemic played out, again, as justification for our mission and goal of reforming emergency health laws. We also are building a professional panel. And while initially we were thinking of and looking at medical doctors, we've expanded that to include really any professional. And we have different divisions to account for that. To be a member of the professional panel requires only that you endorse our mission of reforming emergency health laws. There's no other obligation for that at all. So any professionals in the listening audience here, please feel free to contact us for more information about that. What we do in building this professional panel is show that there are lots of professionals around the country who do recognize the concerns that we're addressing and support our mission.
Alan, let me ask you, you asked people to contact you if they'd like to be on your list. How would they go about doing that?
The simplest way would be to go to either one of the websites and just scroll down at the bottom. There's information about how to contact us. But for the Pandemic Response Project in particular, the email address, best email address is ncprep, P-R-E-P for Pandemic Response Project, ncprepmanager@gmail.com. But go to either Vaccine Rights or the PandemicResponseProject.com websites and scroll down to the bottom of the homepage and you'll see contact information or you'll see links for contact information. And we welcome people contacting us with any questions or concerns or wish to support. We're developing a volunteer pool as well. No requirement for that at all except a willingness to pitch in and help out. I have a manager, God bless him, who's volunteering time and all of my time on this project as well as volunteer. No one is compensated for anything they're doing with this. But we're compelled by the issue. We see a problem that needs fixing, and we are stepping in with a focus and in an arena where we haven't seen other people, you know, anyone else doing the same thing. So we'd be glad to work with others doing this in any way that we can, and certainly welcome support for anyone of us directly with what we're doing and how we're approaching it as well. We've been developing over the last few months, much slower than I had originally hoped, but nonetheless steadily forward, materials that we will be taking to our state representatives here in North Carolina. At this point, we're planning for that to happen within the next few weeks. We're real close to finishing those materials. We've done a lot of development of them. It turns out quite wonderfully, I think, that in this having taken longer for us to complete than I had initially hoped, that a lot of new information, very relevant and important information, has come to light. So if perhaps ironically, I'm glad that we haven't moved forward sooner than this, because we've gotten to see, you know, last fall we were looking at all kinds of concerns about what might happen. Now at this point, we can look back retrospectively and say, hey, look, all those concerns we were talking about, they actually played out. And here's the evidence, and here are the authoritative sources stating it and documenting it. So it's been you know, fascinating to see how that has played out, and we've gotten more new and better information to pull together as part of our information that we're going to take to state representatives. But we'll be making this information available for anybody else to use in any other state, and we're glad to help people in other states do the same thing any way that we can. This is something that ultimately is a state-by-state issue as well as a federal issue. So ultimately, in that sense, to one degree or another, we're all on our own. But at the same time, I think there are wheels here that don't have to be reinvented, at least not entirely. And so I think we can all work together in different states to support one another, not just morally, but with information and feedback about how the process unfolds in each individual state. We can all learn from one another and achieve these goals more effectively with that kind of mutual support.
That's great. I've been speaking with Alan Phillips, vaccines rights attorney and founder of the Pandemic Response Project. Alan, would love to have you back on a future date. There's a lot more material out there that we have to discuss and get out to the public, including our member doctors who need to be informed about what the state laws are, as well as what's happening at the federal level, as well as what's happening at the international level. Maybe that's something that you and I can discuss next time, is that a lot of this stuff, especially with the H1N1 vaccine, was not only pushed by the feds and the states, but also at the international level. Alan, thank you very much, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
It's been my great pleasure, Michael. Thanks for having me, and I would love to come back.